And Everything Remains as It Never Was by Kitsunare 88. Percy stares down at the parchment, the words blurring. The air in his office is old and stale, the light spells buzzing and flickering slightly. They need to be renewed, but the maintenance staff hasn't gotten to it yet, though he filed the request a week ago. It's been months since the end of the war, but evidence of you-know-who and his reign of terror still litter the ministry. Marks on the walls may be all that's left of the pure-blood propaganda posters that adorned them, but the dividers on their cubicles, once giving a semblance of privacy, have been more permanently cut to half size. The Death Eaters had wanted to keep an eye on them, and the room is frighteningly open. Percy feels the gaze of Runcorn on the back of his head, for all that Runcorn is dead, and Percy was the one to make it so. He puts down the parchment and reaches for a fresh scroll. The fiscal report numbers don't change, no matter how he arranges them. The fact of the matter is that the ministry doesn't have enough money, and foreign aid is minimal, slow to arrive, and humiliating to request. Damage from the war is extensive. The ministry was hard hit, but so was the rest of Wizarding Britain. The flu system has been essentially dismantled. Hogwarts, Hogsmeade, and Diagon Alley all show signs of widespread destruction, buildings blasted and crumbling. That doesn't even begin with the invisible damages, disappeared and burnt records from the ministry, many of which Percy or his surviving co-workers had taken and destroyed themselves, or the empty desks from people who had fled abroad and didn't plan on coming back. Or the people who died. There were so many people who died. Unsurprisingly, Voldemort and his Death Eaters had absolutely destroyed the treasury. War reparations were an option, but that needed to wait for trials, and until then, there is Percy, and his quill, and his endless requests for international aid. The sun is setting, another late night, and for a long moment Percy considers going home. And then, like clockwork, he puts his quill to parchment and starts drafting another appeal for humanitarian aid. A voice clears from the door. Percy looks up from his desk. His father is standing there, red hair thin and graying on the top of his head. He has more lines on his face than he did a few months ago, and his shoulders are slumped. Since the war, he oversees the improper use of magic office, which Percy thinks he doesn't especially like, but that he's doing because, well, there aren't very many people left. "Dad?" The word comes out stiff and awkward. He knows why Dad's there. It's the same reason Dad has come by his office for weeks, and this one will be no different.
"Your mother's making a pot roast on Sunday,"
Dad says, just as Percy expected. And there are 1,000 words that go unsaid. There are the words that he and Dad flung at each other when the war was just starting, when Percy moved out. There are the words that Percy never said when Fred died.
"I'm sorry for what I said. I'm sorry I called you a ministry sycophant. I'm glad you came back."
"I'm sorry I left. I'm sorry about Fred. I'm sorry I distracted him, that maybe if I hadn't left, if I had come back earlier, if I wasn't there at all, if he might be alive." They don't say them.
"You should come. Your mother and brothers would love to see you."
Dad shifts in the doorway.
"Bill and Charlie will be there."
Percy would like to see Bill and Charlie. He'd like to see Mum, too, and George, and Ron, and Ginny. And Harry would no doubt be there. And where there was Ron and Harry, there would be Hermione. It would be a gathering, the same as every Sunday, and it would be
loud,
awkward, anxiety-inducing, filled with guilt and fear and accusations. He doesn't know. He doesn't want to know.
"I'll think about it," Percy replies, much as he has every time Dad has come by.
It's been weeks. He hasn't seen the rest of his family since Fred's funeral. He doesn't know if he wants to.
Please, Purse,
Dad says, and there's a note of pleading in his voice.
We'd love to see you.
Percy can't help but read into the pause. Who was we? And did they really want to see him? Or was this obligation? A sense that Percy was a Weasley and therefore he should be at Sunday night dinner? Or was this a chance to throw stones? For his family to cast the blame on him that Percy's still learning to live with himself?
I'll think about it, he repeats.
But both he and Dad know how incredibly unlikely it is that he'll go. There's a long silence, one in which Percy can hear the faint buzz of the lighting spells in the air, while Dad gives him a long, searching, almost helpless stare. And then Dad sighs.
All right, then. But you're always welcome, Purse. You know that, right? Of course,
Percy replies. He doesn't believe it. Dad studies him for another moment, and then he sighs deeply and leaves. Percy turns back to his work, yet another request for humanitarian aid. This one is a specific appeal to Wizarding America, a country with strong historic ties to Wizarding Britain, and Percy is in the middle of a long dissertation on their history of mutual aid when soft words cross the air of his stale office.
You should go.
He looks up. It's easy to forget that the Department of International Cooperation is not only him. They are severely understaffed, but the office isn't empty. There's him, and there is Pansy Parkinson, and a half dozen others in the London office. There are more staff abroad, and once, Percy dreamt of being given an overseas diplomatic posting. He doesn't dream about that anymore. Mostly because he doesn't dream. Right now, it's only him and Pansy Parkinson in the office. Parkinson was hired because she speaks French, all the better to draft pleas for assistance from the entire Francophonie. She's standing in her cubicle, three rows away from him, leaning on the partition with a quill dangling from her hand. There are dark bags under her eyes, and her mouth is turned down in a frown. She works as long as Percy does.
I beg your pardon.
You should go,
she repeats, and even if her voice is quiet, it echoes around the room. Percy stares at her, at the bags under her eyes, and the dark hair framing her face. He knows that the Parkinsons sat on the other side of the war with you-know-who. He even knows that Parkinson herself wanted to give Harry Potter up to you-know-who. He thinks for a long minute on how to respond. He doesn't know Parkinson personally, but he knows that he shouldn't associate with her. Her parents, even if not Death Eaters, supported them. Parkinson herself was, by all accounts, awful.
Mind your own business, he says coldly, and her dark eyes shudder.
Very well, she says, and her voice is thick with bitterness. I'll leave you to wallow in your guilt, then. Merlin knows there's enough of that to go around.
She sits back down in her own cubicle, leaving Percy alone. And after a moment, Percy can hear the scratching of her quill from across the room. He turns back to his own work, writing another sentence about past treaties and mutual aid agreements with the Americans. The quill blots. He's taking too much time to think, much more time than it should take to write this request, and it's badly written anyway. In disgust, he crumples his request and tosses it into the closest bin. And then he gets up and stomps over to Parkinson's cubicle.
What would you know about guilt? He snaps.
Parkinson is working, a request for aid to the Swiss on her desk.
You, your family, were you-know-who supporters. You offered to give Harry Potter up to him. What reason do you have for guilt?
Parkinson looks up, her brows furrowed and angry.
And you worked for the ministry that supports him.
Percy swallows. I fought. I made records disappear. I removed flu connections. I fought in the battle for Hogwarts.
Who cares? Parkinson snorts. I sat in the Hogshead, taking care of 100 terrified children during the battle of Hogwarts. I held hands and told them that everything would be all right, even if I didn't know whether it would be or not. I could have left, but I didn't. No one talks about that.
You offered to give Harry Potter up to you-know-who.
I was 17 and terrified. You were older when you decided to throw your lot in with the ministry, and then, when everything came out, it was too late, wasn't it?
Parkinson shook her head, her nose wrinkling.
We aren't made up of the good and the bad, Weasley. We're people who made decisions on the best information available to us at the time, and some of them were better than others. And we live with our mistakes. What do you want? Redemption? Salvation? Someone to look at you and tell you what a good boy you've been, or that it's all okay and everything is dandy?
Percy says, and he stops because he doesn't know. He doesn't know what he wants. He wants Fred back. He wants there to have been no war at all. He wants to have been right, because deep down a part of him believes that sticking with the ministry was the right thing to do. For all that Dumbledore had said that they were on the same side, as long as that side was fighting Voldemort, Dumbledore had gone and made the Order of the Phoenix a private army outside the law. He wants to be understood, to be in the inner circle of a family where he's always felt an outsider. He wants things that he can't have. Parkinson snorts, turning back to her desk.
You have a family left, and that's more than many can say. You should go have dinner with them. Take what you can get, Weasley.
And you? Percy can't help but ask. What about?
My family was on the wrong side of a war.
Parkinson shakes her head.
It doesn't matter that I was 17 and terrified. It doesn't matter that my parents weren't Death Eaters, or that they only gave money to you-know-who because they were terrified of what might happen if we didn't. Our family assets are still frozen, and my parents are still on trial, and we still carry the stigma of being what we weren't. Might as well get on with it.
She turns back to her appeal, pointedly ignoring Percy. And after a minute, he coughs.
I'm off for the night, he says, hitching his shoulders. Have a good evening.
She doesn't answer. Her hands are already thumbing through a reference book, no doubt checking the details of some treaty or other. The next day is Saturday, and Percy doesn't go into the office. He often does, but this weekend he avoids it. Parkinson might be there. Parkinson, with the harsh frown on her face and pained dark eyes and mouth that spills jaded realities. He doesn't want that. He doesn't want to deal with that. Instead, he putters around his flat. He lives in the Muggle world. It's cheaper than in the Wizarding one, especially with apparition and the flu. And while his reasons were monetary, it ended up being some small measure of protection during the war. He goes to Tesco's at a reasonable hour for once, coming home with armfuls of groceries that he carefully packs away, for all that half of it will go moldy before he gets around to eating it. He makes breakfast, and then he sits with the Daily Prophet and tries to read it. Shacklebolt is on the front cover, expounding about justice for the past 3 years of war crimes. The trials are starting, with the Malfoys being first in the dock. But Percy suspects that it's because the Malfoys are pleading out to lesser crimes in exchange for house arrest. Some people are furious, wanting the ministry to pin them for everything they've ever done. But Percy? Percy doesn't care. He wonders where the line is between Death Eater supporters, willing bystanders, and the terrified people who did what they thought they had to do to survive. What about people like Draco Malfoy, a marked Death Eater who had been a child, who obviously during the war had simply stopped caring who won as long as the terror stopped? What about Pansy Parkinson, a scared 17-year-old who said they should give up Harry Potter to save the rest of them? What about him, who put his faith in the ministry before you-know-who had announced his return? He puts down the paper in favor of making a gloriously complicated lunch, which then turns into another time-consuming and finicky recipe for supper. He eats ungodly early. Then he curls up on his sofa with a book, only to find that the words escape from his brain the minute he reads them. Disgusted, he tosses the book on his side table.
You should go, Parkinson's voice whispers in his mind. Take what you can get.
Fred is dead, but the rest of his family is alive. Percy goes to bed. He wakes up in the morning without ever having felt like he fell asleep. Intellectually, he knows he must have slept. He'd turned in early, and he doesn't have 10 hours of memories of staring at his ceiling, waiting for sleep to come, while too many thoughts jostle for room in his head. He should go to dinner. He doesn't want to. What would his family say to see him? He doesn't want to know, or does he? Without knowing, he can imagine that it might be open-armed acceptance, that what Dad says might really be true, and that they're delighted to see him. He can even dream that it might be more than that, that he wouldn't be the odd, rules-abiding, pretentious child in the middle of a family of danger-seekers. The minute he steps over the threshold of his childhood home, those possibilities vanish. What happens will happen, and it will be only what it is. Happiness to see him, or anger, or disappointment, or any of 100 reactions that he can't even fully contemplate. He'd like to see Bill and Charlie, at least. He'd like to see Mom. He'd like to see the rest of his family, too, though the prospect of facing them, of facing George, is terrifying. Would George blame him? How could he not? There'll be an empty chair at the dinner table. And even if there isn't, even if the literal chair is now gone, the space for Fred will be there in everyone's mind. There will be 2 empty chairs if Percy doesn't go. He gets up. He frets over his morning shower, over making a second elaborate breakfast and then an equally elaborate lunch. The news hasn't changed enough in one day for the Daily Prophet to interest him, and even a deep clean of his flat doesn't take the entire day. It isn't big enough.
Take what you can get, Weasley.
Mom always has dinner ready at 6 in the evening. It's habit, she's always said. The hour that Dad gets home from work, and a handful of young children can eat and get ready for bed at a reasonable hour. Supper hasn't changed, not even with the children grown and gone. And Percy knows that if he goes to the borough for 6, there will be dinner. At 4, he's done cleaning his flat. At 5, he's done his laundry. At 5:30, his shoes have been shined. Oh, what the hell, he mutters to himself at 5:45, and he marches to his closet for his coat. He apparates to the borough before he can think better of it. The front of the house hasn't changed much from his memories. Rubber wellies still litter the ground in front of it, for all that Percy and his siblings have largely outgrown them. The chicken coop is still there. The hatch door repaired yet again, and the house leans just as much as ever. He walks in, the blast of warm air carrying the familiar scent of cooking beef and potatoes and carrots and gravy. It's loud, voices carrying out into the front hallway.
I wonder who that,
Mum is saying, and then her head pokes out of the kitchen.
Percy!
Mum,
Percy says. But it's all he can get out before Mom is on him, smothering him with a hug, and he can feel the drips of gravy marked on her apron, pressing into his t-shirt. He pats her on the back, awkward, and over her shoulder he can see Ron's head looking out from the sitting room.
Puss, he says,
and from the tone of his voice, Percy can't read anything. He's not smiling, but then it's Ron, and he wouldn't to see Percy. He also doesn't sound unhappy to see him. He just sounds observant. A second later, Harry's head pops out of the sitting room as well.
Dad told me there would be a pot roast, Percy says.
He stops himself from fidgeting, which he can't do anyway with Mum's arms around him. Mum pulls herself away from him. There are tears in her eyes, but an understanding tilt to her mouth, and she just wipes them away with the back of one hand without comment.
Yes, pot roast. It was always your favorite, wasn't it? Come in. Bill, can you pull out an extra chair? I think we'll be eating in the garden. It's still warm enough out for that, and there's a bit more space.
And that is that. Percy walks into the house, and he helps set up the dinner table the way he always has. He finds the glasses in the same cupboard they've always been, spills them with aguamenti, and puts them around the table. He sits down at the same seat that he always has, between Bill and George, and the food is as good as he remembers. He listens to the talk around them. Ginny's upcoming 7th year at Hogwarts. Hermione's plans to return for a proper 7th year. Ron and Harry's plans to go right into aura training. George and the shop. Fred isn't there. George sounds tired, even as he talks about his plans for the shop, and Ginny's eyes are haunted in a way they haven't been since the end of her 1st year. Bill's face is scarred, George is missing an ear, and Percy can see a scar spelling out mudblood, half hidden under Hermione's rolled-up sleeve. Everyone looks older than their years.
"All right there, Perce?"
Bill asks quietly, while Dad is complaining about budget issues at the improper use of magic office. Percy thinks about it, chewing on a piece of beef. He swallows.
"No," he says. "Is anyone?"
Bill nods, understanding, and they turn back to the table. They don't speak of it again. They don't need to. Percy takes what he can get.